Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Boulder Daily News, read by Kathy Piancone. This is being recorded on Tuesday, April 30th. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Oil and gas industry. Polis, lawmakers, unveil climate change deal, by Seth Klaman and Nick Coltrane. Healthcare. Court. Transgender coverage policies discriminate, by Lee Willingham. Downtown Boulder development. Proposed St. Julian expansion sparks backlash in Boulder, by Amber Carlson. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Oil and gas industry. Polis, lawmakers, unveil climate deal. Agreement calls for Dems to abandon bills, industry to drop ballot measures. By Seth Klaman and Nick Coltrane. Leading Colorado Democrats and the state's oil and gas industry announced a preemptive armistice Monday, one that seeks to defuse the latest round of dueling ballot initiatives and legislation aimed at the industry and its environmental impacts. The proposals, described to reporters by Governor Jared Polis and legislative leadership, include imposing a new per-barrel production fee on the industry and enacting new environmental standards. In exchange, the industry, lawmakers, and several environmental groups agreed to abandon recent attempts at regulatory legislation and ballot initiatives that are backed by deep pockets. In coming together, this diverse group agreed that costly, divisive ballot measures and legislation are not in the interest of the state, and it's better to find a way to work together to an outcome that everybody can live with and moves the ball down the field in terms of achieving our goals, Polis said. A key part of the deal takes the form of two new bills set to be introduced in the coming days, roughly 1 week before the end of the legislature's 2024 session. One bill would institute a fluctuating production fee on oil and gas that's expected to generate roughly $138 million annually, based on returns from recent years. Much of that money would go towards supporting transit in Colorado, particularly including Metro Denver's Regional Transportation District. The state also would set aside a slice to help restore public lands impacted by oil and gas production. The second bill would seek to reduce emissions and improve air quality via new permitting and enforcement authority. It would include funding to plug orphan wells and strategies to help communities that are disproportionately impacted by the oil and gas industry, Polis and legislative leaders said at Monday's late afternoon conference. Polis said negotiations included major players in the oil and gas industry, legislators who had eyed tighter regulations on production, and several environmental groups, with eight of the latter named in a news release. The deal means that ballot initiatives filed by both the industry and by environmentalists, and at various stages of state review, will be abandoned. Those supported by the industry, which has the money to run effective campaigns backing them, were seen as particularly concerning to environmentalists, since among the aims was to thwart state and local regulations. In turn, Environmental groups filed ballot measures targeted at addressing the industry's harms on public health and the environment. Democrats in the legislature agreed to drop four bills that had been winding through its chambers. Those measures sought to curb emissions by changing the state's permitting process, halting drilling in the summer, and increasing potential penalties for companies that violate their air pollution permits. If the two new bills win approval, the environmental groups, legislators, and key industry players agree not to run any new ballot measures or legislation for the next few years. Polis and Senate President Steve Fenberg told reporters the timeout was intended to give the new policies time to be implemented. But if the bill fails, the state will continue along the status quo, Fenberg said. Stability and certainty is vital to industry. The political breakthrough was welcomed by Dan Haley, the president and CEO of the Colorado Oil and Gas Association. He said in a statement that the industry still was absorbing dozens of new regulations at various stages of implementation. Colorado's oil and natural gas industry has been leading the state in emissions reductions and has been at the table for more than two dozen rulemakings in just the past few years, he said. But political and legislative stability and certainty is vital to our industry's future success here, and we're pleased to see our state's political leaders share that vision. Kate Schwartz, the director of the American Petroleum Institute's Colorado chapter, echoed in a statement that stability for a vital industry is of utmost importance. The oil and gas industry supported 54,420 direct jobs and 249,320 indirect jobs in the state in 2021, accounting for about 7.7% of the state's total employment, according to a report last May from the American Petroleum Institute. The industry contributed $48.7 billion to the state's economic output, or about 11% of the total. The governor's office said the oil and gas producers, Occidental, Civitas, and Chevron, were involved in the coalition and supported the new legislation. A collection of environmental groups that took part in the talks sent out a joint statement at about the same time as the industry, calling on the legislature to pass the package. Signed by Conservation Colorado, Green Latinos, the Southwest Energy Efficiency Project, and others, the statement warned that without the bills, the state would see potentially devastating ballot measures from the oil and gas industry that could have rolled back a decade of climate progress in Colorado. These bills represent significant progress for disproportionately impacted communities, providing much-needed protections from pollution, resources to enhance the lives of transit-dependent individuals, and crucial remediation efforts for both the ecosystem and affected communities, added Ian Thomas Tafoya, the Colorado State Director of Green Latinos. Republican leadership in the state House did not offer immediate comment on the proposals. Senator Barbara Kirkmeyer, a Brighton Republican, said she had not seen the new legislation. Her district includes Weld County, which produces most of the oil and gas in the state. She said she'd take a cautious look at each bill before committing one way or another, keeping workers in mind as she considered it. It's not about the oil and gas companies getting something. It's not about, are we satisfying the environmentalists, she said. It's really about, how do we protect those workers in the industry and give them certainty that they have a future where they're going to make a great income to be able to provide for their family? Details on two new bills. House Speaker Julie McCluskey said the permitting and air quality bills would include funding specific to orphan wells and marginal wells, plus specific direction to the Colorado Energy and Carbon Management Commission around minimizing impacts to disproportionately impacted communities. That refers to communities that are likely to experience high levels of harm from poor environmental quality. The bill would codify a 30% nitric oxide reduction from oil and gas production by 2025 and a 50% cut by 2030, McCluskey said, and it would also strengthen enforcement mechanisms. Under the oil and gas production fees bill, 80% of proceeds would go to local transit agencies like RTD and to rail projects and a competitive grant program for transit. The remaining 20% would go to habitat conservation and restoration as mitigation for oil and gas activities on public lands, Polis said. The governor said the per-barrel fee, set to fluctuate based on market conditions, would have a minimal effect on energy prices in the state as it filters through international markets. He noted that other states have higher severance taxes than Colorado and would continue to do so under this proposal. Staff writer Aldo Svaldi contributed to this story. Healthcare. Court. Transgender coverage policies discriminate. By Lee Willingham. West Virginia's and North Carolina's refusal to cover certain healthcare for transgender people with a government-sponsored insurance is discriminatory, a federal appeals court ruled Monday in a case likely headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Richmond-based 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 8-6 in the case involving coverage of gender-affirming care by North Carolina's state employee health plan and the coverage of gender-affirming surgery by West Virginia Medicaid. Specifically, North Carolina's policy bars treatments or studies leading to or in connection with sex changes or modifications and related care, while West Virginia's bars coverage of transsexual surgery. The coverage exclusions facially discriminate on the basis of sex and gender identity and are not substantially related to an important government interest, Judge Roger Gregory, first appointed by former President Bill Clinton and reappointed by former President George W. Bush, wrote in the majority opinion. Similar cases are under consideration in courts across the country, but Monday's is the first U.S. Court of Appeals decision to consider government-sponsored coverage exclusions of gender-affirming medical care and whether those exclusions are lawful. The ruling follows a decision earlier this month by Fourth Circuit judges that West Virginia's transgender sports ban violates the rights of a teen athlete under Title IX, the federal civil rights law that prohibits sex-based discrimination in schools. Like with the transgender sports law ruling, West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey said his office planned to appeal Monday's health care case decision. Decisions like this one, from a court dominated by Obama and Biden appointees, cannot stand. We'll take this up to the Supreme Court and win, Morrissey said in a statement. North Carolina State Treasurer Dale Falwell, whose department oversees the state's health plan, said in a news release that Monday's majority decision was in direct conflict with other decisions from federal appeals court and hopefully will be corrected by the U.S. Supreme Court. Falwell said the state health plan is threatened by financial challenges as the plan's members grow older and their health declines. Accordingly, the plan cannot be everything for everyone, Falwell said. Untethered to the reality of the plan's fiscal situation, The majority opinion opens the way for any dissatisfied individual to override the plan's reasoned and responsible decisions and drive the plan towards collapse. In the majority opinion, judges said the cost of treatment is not a sufficient argument to support upholding a policy found to be discriminatory. Especially where government budgets are involved, there will frequently be a rational basis for discrimination, Judge Gregory wrote. Both states appealed separate lower court rulings that found the denial of gender-affirming care to be discriminatory and unconstitutional. Two panels of three Fourth Circuit judges heard arguments in both cases last year before deciding to intertwine the two cases and see them presented before the full court. In June 2022, a North Carolina trial court demanded the state plan pay for medically necessary services, including hormone therapy and some surgeries for transgender employees and their children. The judge had ruled in favor of the employees and their dependents, who said in a 2019 lawsuit that they were denied coverage for gender-affirming care under the plan. The North Carolina State Insurance Plan provides medical coverage for more than 750,000 teachers, state employees, retirees, lawmakers, and their dependents. In August 2022, a federal judge ruled West Virginia's Medicaid program must provide coverage for gender-affirming care for transgender residents. An original lawsuit filed in 2020 also named the state employee health plans. A settlement with the health plan of West Virginia Incorporated in 2022 led to the removal of the exclusion on gender-affirming care in that company's public employees insurance agency plans. The state's lawyers argued that treatments for gender dysphoria, all treatments in North Carolina, and surgical treatments in West Virginia are excluded from coverage for everyone, regardless of their gender identity. They claimed only a subset of transgender people suffer from gender dysphoria, a diagnosis of distress over gender identity that does not match a person's assigned sex. Before offering pharmaceutical or surgical intervention, medical guidelines call for thorough psychological assessments to confirm gender dysphoria before starting any treatment. In his opinion, Gregory said that in his view, gender dysphoria is so intimately related to transgender status as to be virtually indistinguishable from it. We hold that gender dysphoria, a diagnosis inextricable from transgender status, is a proxy for transgender identity, the judge wrote. And coverage exclusions that bar treatments for gender dysphoria bar treatments on the basis of transgender identity by proxy. Unlike North Carolina, West Virginia has covered hormone therapy and other pharmaceutical treatments for transgender people since 2017. Gregory noted that West Virginia's program partially or fully covers surgeries to remove and reconstruct sexual organs for non-gender dysphoria-related diseases such as cancer. After the ruling, West Virginia plaintiff Shantae Anderson, a Black transgender woman and West Virginia medical participant, called her state's refusal to cover her care deeply dehumanizing. I'm so relieved that this court ruling puts us one step closer to the day when Medicaid can no longer deny transgender West Virginians access to the essential health care that our doctors say is necessary for us, Anderson said in a statement. Downtown Boulder development. Proposed St. Julian expansion sparks backlash in Boulder, by Amber Carlson. A planned expansion of the iconic St. Julian Hotel in downtown Boulder is drawing criticism from some community members. Although the hotel expansion, which has been in the works for years, is required to include space for civic and community use, some in the community are expressing concerns about a myriad of issues, ranging from increasing traffic to obstructing mountain views to whether the development aligns with the city's intent for the area. Before the St. Julian was built at 958 Walnut Street, the land at the northeast corner of 9th and Canyon Boulevard was the biggest piece of undeveloped land in downtown Boulder. City documents describe the space as a key gateway between the Civic Center, where the municipal building and library are located, and the downtown business district. It also offers a view of the Flatirons to the southwest. The city's 9th and Canyon Urban Renewal Plan, first adopted in 1988 and later updated, envisioned the land being developed in a way that allowed at least 20% of the gross developed area to be set aside for civic uses. The 149,950 square foot hotel now sits on the site, along with an underground parking garage that can accommodate more than 600 vehicles. But the site hasn't been developed for civic uses yet. The civic use pad space sits just east of the hotel, bordered by Canyon Boulevard on the south and 10th Street Connector on the north. St. Julian Partners, LLC, has plans to add a 55-foot-tall, 53,240-square-foot building there with hotel rooms and event spaces that can be rented out to local civic groups and not-for-profit organizations. On the ground floor, the plans for the facility include a prep kitchen and 8,400 square feet of furnished space to host a variety of events such as meetings, fundraisers, art exhibits, and performances. The civic use building is also expected to include 3 floors of extended stay guest rooms, which will be connected with the main hotel via a sky bridge over the 10th Street pedestrian easement, as well as a rooftop that can be booked for events. But a group of community members has coalesced around opposing the Civic Use Pad project. The website of the Protect Boulder Civic Space group says the project as planned would be monolithic and out of character for the neighborhood, drive additional traffic to the area without adding parking, and allow St. Julian to own and control the space at no additional cost. According to city documents, St. Julian already owns the civic use pad area, but has agreed to develop it for use by community groups as well as hotel guests. Still, in a news release, the group cited concerns over how the last civic use space in downtown Boulder with a view of the Flatirons might be developed. Many in downtown and greater Boulder are concerned about this massive development for many reasons, including the height, mass, scale, traffic, safety, fire, parking, access, and floodplain issues, group spokesperson Cindy Lindsay said in a release, adding that the group also wants to ensure the plans for the space match up with the original civic intent of the pad. The Boulder Design Advisory Board discussed the project in December and recommended that some aspects of the project, such as the building facade and the balconies, be changed. One board member, Chair Todd Bryan, said he did not believe the project met city criteria of preserving mountain views and keeping buildings similar in height, mass, and scale to other nearby buildings, but the other 4 board members did not agree. If the project moves ahead as planned, construction documents are expected to be submitted for by later this year, and the civic use building should be complete by the end of 2025. Pronounce this: robotics. Longmont High wins top award by Amy Bounds. The four members of the Longmont High pronounced this robotics team won the top award at the recent high school VEX World Championship, giving them the distinction of the best all-around team out of more than 800 competitors. The team, senior Luke Hernandez and juniors Alex Dickens, Abby Reichert, and Carl Reichert, have been competing together for 3 years, though the students all have participated in competitive robotics starting in either elementary or middle school. This is the highest award in the world at the biggest event, said Hernandez, the team driver who also helps build the bot. To be one of the teams to win this award is crazy. The Excellence Award is given to the team that scores well in every category, from robot skills to design to research. Teams also are judged on an engineering notebook and interviews with judges about their robot and process. We're really excited about this group, said Alexandra Downing, St. Vrain's Competitive Robotics Program Manager. They worked so hard, and they deserve it. They've built such a strong community for the younger kids because of how they mentor. Reichert, the team's project manager and engineering notebooker, said mentoring younger students is her favorite part. She started competing in third grade. I'm really passionate about it, she said. I really like helping younger kids get into something I love so much. Altogether, 19 St. Vrain Valley teams competed or are competing in the VEX Robotics World Championship in Dallas, which started last week and is continuing this week. Last week's competition was for the high school VEX VRC program, with students competing with robots built mainly with metal parts. The middle school version of that competition wraps up Tuesday. St. Vrain sent 7 middle school and 6 high school teams to the VRC competition. Later this week, VEX-IQ program teams will compete. In VEX-IQ, elementary and middle school students build robots with mainly plastic parts. St. Vrain is sending 4 elementary and 2 middle school teams to the IQ competition. St. Vrain Valley fields around 264 VEX robotic teams and hosts more than 20 tournaments during the competition season, including the state IQ tournament. For the VEX competition, 2 teams partner against another 2 teams with the goal of earning as many points as possible by completing challenges with a robot on a field. This year's challenge resembles a soccer field and requires both scoring on a goal and defending it. The 2 partner teams work together to develop strategies based on their respective robots' strengths. The Pronounce This team took its 5th version of its robot to this year's world competition, rebuilding it to incorporate improvements throughout the season. Team members said they built a simple but durable offensive bot. When it's simple, there are less points for failure, said Reichter, a team designer and builder. Our robot is pretty reliable. That makes us more competitive at the higher level matches. Added Hernandez, we had to make sure we were as light and quick as possible. Along with bringing a solid robot and working well with their partner teams, the students said they aced the interviews with the judges. Building the robot entirely by themselves without adult help gave them a depth of understanding in answering questions that some of the other teams lacked, they said. Dickens, the team's programmer, said the robotics competitions are unique because of the camaraderie among the teams and the willingness to help, including loaning extra parts for repairs if a team's robot stops working. We're all competing against each other, but we're all in it together, he said. He added that hearing the team's number announced for the top award while surrounded by more than 8,000 robotic students and spectators was entirely unreal. "We put so much work into it," he said. "It was totally exhilarating." Legislative Digest. Governor Polis signs budget. House passes gun reform bills. By Nick Coltrane and Seth Klammen. Colorado lawmakers are racing against the calendar to finish their business for the 2024 regular session of the General Assembly before adjournment on May 8th. On Monday, legislators and Governor Jared Polis checked off a major to-do item with the finalization of the state budget. In other action, the House and Senate passed high-profile legislation in committees and on the floor, including a proposed ballot measure aimed at repealing Colorado's same-sex marriage ban and two gun reform bills. During a ceremony on the state capitol's west steps, Polis signed the $40 billion-plus budget for the next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. And with his signature, Colorado is in constitutional compliance for the first time in more than a decade. The budget zeroes out the so-called negative factor, or the gap between what the state pays into education and what the Colorado Constitution requires. It equals about $737 more per student across the state, Polis said. It can't be overstated how crucial it is that this is the first time in over 10 years, probably 14 years, that we've been constitutionally compliant in our funding for K through 12 public schools, Representative Sharon Byrd, a Westminster Democrat and chair of the Joint Budget Committee, said. This year marked a return to normal, limited budgets, compared to the topsy-turvy spending plans of the COVID pandemic, when the state faced deep cuts before then receiving a flood of federal money, budget writers said. But they still found cash to boost auto theft prevention, increase higher education funding, add more than 120 beds for intellectual and developmentally disabled Coloradans, and increase the number of days people can stay at behavioral health facilities. Still other increases include creating a stipend program for homeless youth to pay for college tuition and related costs that might be barriers to higher education. House passes gun-carrying restriction. After lengthy debates, the House passed two gun reform bills. One, Senate Bill 131, would prohibit people from taking firearms into the state capitol and certain other government buildings or offices, onto school and university campuses, and to licensed childcare facilities. Senate Bill 3 directs more than $1 million of the Colorado Bureau of Investigation to investigate illegal gun sales, plus nearly $400,000 more for other purposes. Both bills previously passed the Senate but have undergone changes in the House, meaning their sponsors will now decide what to do with those changes before sending the measures to Polis's desk. Republicans opposed both measures, as did some moderate Democrats. They argued that the bill limiting where a gun could be carried would make those spaces less safe. Representative Jennifer Bacon, a Denver Democrat, countered that the violence should not be solved solely through more violence, and legislators said they feel unsafe because some Republican colleagues carry firearms. Earlier this month, Republican Representative Don Wilson left a loaded gun in a Capitol bathroom. Last year, two firearms were stolen from a Republican Representative Ron Weinberg's car outside of the Capitol. The year before that, Republican Representative Richard Haltroff dropped his gun in a public area while running to vote. Republicans support marriage ban repeal. The Senate voted 29-5 to let voters amend the Colorado Constitution to remove a defunct provision that defines marriage as between a man and a woman. The provision hasn't been enforceable since the landmark 2015 U.S. Supreme Court decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, which legalized same-sex marriage nationwide. Republican Senators Mark Baisley, Byron Pelton, Rod Pelton, Kevin Van Winkle, and Perry Will voted against the measure. It still needs approval in the House, where Democrats hold a supermajority, before it goes to voters for approval. Republicans hold a minority of seats in the Senate as well, but have enough seats to stop proposed constitutional amendments, which require two-thirds support if they unify against them. They used that margin earlier this session to stop a proposed amendment aimed at allowing people to bring civil claims of childhood sexual assault, regardless of when that assault happened. But Monday's vote included several Republicans joining with Democrats, easily clearing the two-thirds threshold. Things to do. Today. Dash and Dine, 5K Run, 6:30 p.m., Boulder Reservoir, 5565 North 51st Street, Boulder. Starting and finishing at the Boulder Reservoir, the 5K out and back course follows the roads and dams on the south of the reservoir. Dinner is served afterwards for all paid entries. Hang out afterwards under the fading sunset skies for overall age group recognitions and giveaways. $30 to $40. DashNDine5K.com. Open Mic Poetry Night, 5 p.m. Carbon Valley Regional Library, 7 Park Avenue, Firestone. Celebrate National Poetry Month by bringing in a poem, song lyric, or original work to share with the group. The open mic is a great opportunity to share in a supportive and encouraging environment. Refreshments will be provided for ages 12 to 18. Registration required. Free. highplains.libcal.com. Conversations in English, 2 p.m. Meadows Branch Library, 4800 Baseline Road, Boulder. Boulder Public Library District offers free Conversations in English, CIE, groups for adult English language learners to practice their speaking and listening skills in a friendly and informal environment. This program is for individuals 18 and over who live, work, or are visiting in Boulder County. calendar.boulderlibrary.org. Tomorrow, God and Country Film Screening, 4:30 p.m. Wednesday, Dairy Arts Center, 2590 Walnut Street, Boulder. From producer Rob Reiner, God and Country looks at the implications of Christian nationalism and how it distorts not only the constitutional republic, but Christianity itself. Featuring prominent Christian thought leaders, the film asks this question: what happens when a faith built on love, sacrifice, and forgiveness grows political tentacles, conflating power, money, and belief into hyper-nationalism? $12. TheDairy.org. PR Labs Run Group with Coach Kelly Lutz, 6 p.m. Wednesday. Performance and Recovery Labs, 2595 Canyon Boulevard, Suite 150, Boulder. Discover the latest Hoka models as a fun addition to the standing bi-weekly run. Seasoned runners or those just starting out can join this inclusive, no-drop run group for the 10 to 13 plus minute runners. Free. 720-600-2208, prsportslab.com. Corey Simmons at the Velvet Elk Lounge, 8 p.m. Wednesday, the Velvet Elk Lounge, 2037 13th Street, Boulder. Corey Simmons ties his lyrical insights together with an array of instrumental sounds and meaningful rhythms that tug at the heartstrings of his audiences. Inspired by his surroundings and his life experiences, including the hardships of everyday life, Simmons's music is full of soul. Each element comes together to produce a synthesis that's a rare blend of adventurous and approachable sound, which is carried with precision along a roller coaster of jams. Corey Simmons utilizes his loop station, his original compositions on guitar, and his soulful vocals to produce his original music that is lyrically profound and instrumentally melodic. Free. 303-993-8743. ETIX.com. Sketch Club. 4 p.m. Wednesday. Carbon Valley Regional Library. 7 Park Avenue, Firestone. Teen artists that like to draw, paint, doodle, or collage can bring their favorite pencils and their creativity to Sketch Club. The club meets the first Wednesday of each month for an hour of open studio time filled with new art challenges, contests, learning, and practicing new techniques and lots of fun. For grades 6 through 12, free. highplains.libcal.com. Game of Thrones Book Group, 6 p.m. Wednesday, Barbed Wire Books, 504 Main Street, Longmont. Let the games begin at this themed book group that meets every first and third Wednesday of the month. BarbedWireBooks.net. David Lawrence and the Spoonful at Rosalie's Pizzeria, 6 p.m. Wednesday, Rosalie's Pizzeria, 461 Main Street, Longmont. David Lawrence has called Colorado home for over a decade. Whether performing solo or with his full band, The Spoonful, Lawrence brings a unique blend of finger-picking blues, roots Americana, soulful vocals, and his style of Django-inspired jazz guitar. Free. RosaliesPizzeria.com. Pickleball, largest indoor center coming to Louisville, by Andrea Grajada. Louisville plans to welcome Colorado's biggest indoor pickleball center in the first 3 months of 2025, when Relish Food Hall and Pickleball is slated to open, with 80,000 square feet in the former Sam's Club building at 550 McCaslin Boulevard. The new business is expected to feature 20 indoor pickleball courts, 2 outdoor courts, a food hall with 8 different restaurants, and plenty of space for the community to gather, founder Tori Leggett and Jeff Youngstrom say. The two have been working for 4 years to open the center, which is next to Ascent Church. The Relish website also lists Hillier Collins as a founder. Leggett and Youngstrom both say they're not the strongest pickleball players. However, they both agree that their focus on the center is not just creating a place to play, but a place to bring people together and create community. Youngstrom credits pickleball's popularity to how accessible and conversational the game is. Leggett added that pickleball is a great way to get to meet new people. Ben Lambert, pickleball director at Relish, said pickleball is a paddle sport that can be played as singles or doubles on a court about half the size of a tennis court. He described the sport as a mix of tennis, badminton, and ping pong. Lambert joked that there's no need for people to use dating apps when it's easy to meet new people by playing pickleball. He explained that during pandemic lockdowns, people were itching for a way to go outside and socialize, which he thinks helped pickleball become more popular. It's a great way to be in the moment, Lambert said. There's no multitasking or sitting around. There's no phones or screens. The smaller court forces players to be closer together physically and encourages people to talk and get to know each other. Lambert said he always finds himself laughing while playing. Originally, when Youngstrom and Leggett had the idea to create a community gathering place, they thought about creating a volleyball or basketball center. But Leggett said the local community convinced them pickleball was popular enough to fill the entire space. The accessibility, the social part, intergenerationality. It's the stuff we wanted for a project to work on, and what we wanted for the community, Leggett said. Youngstrom said it can often be hard to find a place to gather with friends and family outside of the home. He hopes Relish becomes the go-to place for community building. You don't have to be obsessed with pickleball to come here, but you can be, Leggett said. Youngstrom said that as a kid, it was easy for him to have the confidence to join a group of strangers and start playing together. That confidence tends to fade in adulthood, Youngstrom said, but he wants to make sure no one at Relish feels intimidated by the sport. Relish will have membership options and drop-ins, but Leggett and Youngstrom do not intend to exclude anyone. As pickleball is an easy sport to pick up, they intend to welcome any and all to the court. Not only does pickleball forge community, but food does too, the founder said. While the place will have both indoor and outdoor courts, a lot of it has been left open for people to hold meetings, parties, or get a drink with friends. More information about Relish is at visitrelish.com. Glenn Miller Archive, The Man Behind the Music, by Olivia Doak. The University of Colorado Boulder announced it will begin unlocking the Glenn Miller Archive, a collection of about 1,400 boxes, after receiving donor support for their archival project. A national search for an archivist to lead the project is underway. Once hired, the archivist will spend 2 years assembling, cataloging, and preserving the collection. Glenn Miller is a notable CU Boulder alum who attended the university for 3 semesters before becoming one of the most successful big band musicians of the 20th century. The personal papers, photographs, music, and other ephemera of the legendary Glenn Miller shed light on the man behind the music and opens an extensive new collection of research for all to study and enjoy. Kate Tallman, interim faculty director of CU Boulder's Rare and Distinctive Collections, said in a release. Access to primary source materials enables researchers to analyze musical trends and uncover narratives that contribute to a deeper understanding of the music and era. Donors Deanna and Brewster Waddell supported the archival effort. Glenn Miller was one of, if not the, greatest big band leader of his time, Brewster Waddell said in a release. CU Boulder has a very well-respected College of Music, so we thought we'd like to sponsor a jazz program that would bring visibility to CU. Until now, CU Boulder didn't have the resources to fully explore the archive. Alan Cass, a stage manager at CU Boulder's Mackey Auditorium and sports announcer for the Broncos and CU football and basketball games, started the Glenn Miller Collection in the 1970s. He was responsible for most of the collecting and housed the boxes in the basement of Mackey before they were moved to the Norlin Library in 2013. The collection includes jazz, big band, and swing music memorabilia and research materials. Glenn Miller wrote music for and played with the top band leaders of his time, including other American jazz icons like the Dorsey Brothers, Benny Goodman, and Harry James. Glenn Miller's story is more than a musical story. Austin Okijbo, interim director of CU Boulder's American Music Research Center, said in a release, "He's also the American story when examined within the broader context of his ambition to shape the sound of quintessentially American music genres, including jazz, swing, and big band, as well as his role in the war efforts during World War II. Those with questions about the collection can email rad@colorado.edu. Western Slope. Officials confirm fourth wolf attack. Sunday's incident is the sixth separate depredation since 10 wolves were released in December 2023 by Juliana O'Claire. Colorado Parks and Wildlife confirmed a fourth gray wolf livestock attack in Grand County on Sunday, according to the agency's list of confirmed gray wolf depredations. Local CPW staff conducted a field investigation and found injuries on one dead yearling calf consistent with wolf depredation, according to an email from CPW. The incident occurred on the same property as previous depredations on April 17th and 18th. Claims for three separate incidents have not been submitted. Sunday's incident is the fourth confirmed gray wolf depredation in Grand County in April and the sixth separate depredation incident since 10 gray wolves were released in Colorado in December 2023. Colorado's first confirmed wolf depredation after the release occurred on April 2nd in Grand County. The second attack happened 5 days later and 60 miles north in Jackson County. The Middle Park Stock Growers Board requested that CPW officials lethally remove two wolves suspected in the livestock attacks Tuesday. However, officials stated that one wolf suspect in recent depredations is likely denning and in the breeding process. Removing the male wolf would be irresponsible management and potentially cause the den to fail, possibly resulting in the death of the presumed pups, CPW Director Jeff Davis said in a letter to the board Tuesday. Amid reports of livestock depredation, one of the 10 gray wolves reintroduced to Colorado was found dead in Larimer County on April 18th. Initial evidence shows the wolf likely died of natural causes, officials said Tuesday. The approach to lethal removals will likely become more liberal as the wolf population in Colorado grows, according to Davis. Boulder. Two arrested in bike theft investigation. Two men have been arrested by Boulder police in connection to a bike theft investigation in which police found an MDMA lab. A 26-year-old man is charged with 4 counts of second-degree burglary, 3 counts of theft, 7 counts of attempted first-degree trespass, second-degree trespass, third-degree burglary, and 3 counts of burglary tools. Another man, 25, was also arrested and charged with 7 counts of second-degree burglary, 7 counts of theft, 4 counts of criminal mischief, 3 counts of possession of burglary tools, and 2 counts of first-degree trespass, according to the Post. According to a Boulder Police Department Facebook post, the arrests are part of a larger bike theft investigation in which police have so far served 10 warrants, located just under $30,000 worth of items, including bikes and tools, and seized hundreds of items, including 2 firearms, an e-bike, and around a dozen bicycles. In the post, police said an MDMA lab was also found during the investigation and required a hazardous materials team response. According to the police, the investigation remains ongoing, and searches have led police to discover other thefts and unreported crimes in other jurisdictions, such as a golden burglary, in which $20,000 worth of property was stolen, and a Lafayette theft case, where $8,000 worth of tools were stolen. One of the men also has ongoing kidnapping and assault cases in Boulder County. Thanks for joining us for the Boulder Daily News, read by Kathy Piancone.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.